Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. With us are Tara Grishup Goodwin from Kentucky Youth Advocates, where she is lead researcher for a report on supporting the children of parents serving time in Kentucky jails and prisons, and Wendy Hall, program director with Save the Children, and one who has worked in Perry County to keep these families connected. Tara and Wendy, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Tara, let's begin with you and with data and details. What can you tell us about Kentucky kids with parents who've been sent to jail or to prison?
Sure. Well, we have about one out of every 10 kids in the state of Kentucky who have had a parent incarcerated at some point in their lives. And when you think about that, think about a classroom of kids. That would mean about probably two or three students in that classroom has had that experience, if you think about it on average. And, you know, the Annie Casey Foundation raised this issue a number of years ago, and that's when we first started looking at it. And they talked about it as a shared sentence. And it really is. It's something that the kids are feeling and experiencing along with a parent, even though that's not what we tend to think about when a parent gets incarcerated, when they go through that court process. But, you know, in terms of how Kentucky looks compared to other places in the nation, we have the 11th highest rate. We have dropped a little bit. We used to be worse, but I think it's more that other states are getting worse than us improving our numbers on that. So what we did with this report, with in partnership with the Kentucky Social Welfare Foundation, was we really wanted to understand what current practices are out there across the state in jails that are supporting children and families. And we also wanted to learn about what community interest there was in doing more on the issue. And so with the report, we surveyed people out across the state of Kentucky. We received responses from every region of the state. And we got a lot of good information about what current practices were happening with jails and primarily, really, between jails and community partners. And learned a lot of bright spots that were happening, really positive practices, and certainly some opportunities for improvement.
Well, I understand that your survey got responses from more than half of the state's 120 counties, about 65 of them.
That's correct.
What are some highlights of what you learned from that survey?
You know, one of the things we wanted to know was what kind of practices are available currently in the jails. And we heard that a lot of counties have some type of programming in place. But what was less common was something specific around kids. So like having a special place for parents and children to play and connect, for example, on a visit. We learned about what community partners were providing, and only a handful of places reported that there were communities that were providing help for families to pay for calls or help paying for transportation. What was much more common was like education classes for incarcerated parents or things that were happening in, you know, really focused on the adult in the jail cell. So I think that was another area where we saw an opportunity for different community partners to go to their jailer and talk about ways that they could partner up and support the whole family, because often, like we were saying earlier, it's a shared sentence and children are experiencing the impacts of incarceration pretty heavily. We know that having an incarcerated parents is considered an adverse childhood experience because it can be very traumatic for a child to have their parent removed from their home. That can show up in terms of the child's behavior. It could show up in terms of how they're doing with schoolwork and whether they're staying on top of their classes or not. And for some children, it may mean them ending up in foster care or having to move in with a relative or something if they don't have a parent at home to care for them. So other things on the survey that we learned is that we asked about community interest, and by far the majority of respondents wanted to do more to help their local jails improve the visiting process for kids. It was something that people were really interested in doing something about, and clearly we've seen that. We saw that in the survey that there are a lot of counties that are doing some great work.
Did you find that there are significant racial differences involved?
Definitely, when you look at state incarceration data, we see racial disparities. There are many practices historically that have contributed to that. And when we think about differences in access to employment, steady employment, and income, steady income, those are factors that can contribute to differences in incarceration. And so certainly across the state, there are differences and disparities. We see more youth of color who are impacted by incarceration than we do for white kids. But that said, it is also an experience that happens to children across the state of Kentucky. In previous work that we've done, we've looked at it by region, and every single region of the state, I'm sure every single county, has been impacted by incarceration, high rates of incarceration. Here in Kentucky, we also know that we have high rates of females that are incarcerated, and so that means moms are incarcerated at a higher rate than in other places across the country. And so we know there's not a place that's immune to this.
Well, you know, one might think that visiting a parent in prison would be traumatizing for a child, but your research finds, I believe, that maintaining and supporting parental connections during incarceration can actually reduce childhood adversity. Is that right?
Right. You know, it's going to be, every situation is going to need to be looked at, right? We need to make sure it's a safe, healthy relationship and want to support that safe and healthy relationship. But generally speaking, for kids, the fact that their parent has done something wrong doesn't change the fact that they love and care about them. And so when a child is separated from their parent, that does create a trauma. And there is a lot of research that suggests that helping children maintain that connection is really important to helping kids overcome that trauma. But also, in fact, we've heard a lot and have read a lot about how it's beneficial for the person who's been incarcerated. We've heard that from people who work in jails about the positive outcomes they see when they support that parent-child connection, from the people who are incarcerated, so better behavior on the inside. And then one of the quotes we received from somebody who filled out the survey, I think, really summarizes it well. The person said, "Please support anything that would make visiting or talking to children easier. My child was my motivation to do better, and he needed me more than I realized during the time I was away." So certainly there are considerations that need to be taken into account. And in fact, with the support of the Kentucky Social Welfare Foundation, we put out a document a couple of months ago about, it's like a resource guide for families and caregivers on ways they can support children who have an incarcerated parent. And, you know, it includes some prompts like talk with your child about a visit beforehand. See if they're interested, if they're worried about it. Maybe you start with having some consistent phone calls first and then look at visiting. It talks about things you can discuss with the child after a visit occurs to make sure that they can share their feelings, if any feelings came up about that, you know, from the visit, that they can process and talk about it with you. So just hopefully practical things that families and caregivers can do to make sure that that experience isn't causing additional trauma, but is allowing that relationship to be supported and hopefully strengthened. You know, when parents are separated from their children, it can be a time of distance, I guess, in that relationship. And we as community members can try and support that relationship so that the child has that continued support of a parent in their life, and so that parents have that motivation to continue doing good work so they can get out and become a contributing member of society again.
Okay, Tara, if you would stay with us, I want to turn to Wendy now with Save the Children. Wendy, through your work in Perry County, you are an on-the-ground example of supporting kids and incarcerated parents. Tell us about your experience. What's happening in Perry County?
We're doing big things in Perry County. We are watching these kids and parents bond, it's just been amazing to watch. You know, at Save the Children, we believe that every parent and caregiver should have the chance to bond with their child and grow as their child's most important teacher. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to strengthen these relationships, you know, during their roughest times.
How did you make it happen?
So I started going into the Kentucky River Regional Jail around 2018, 2019. And then it looked very different than what it looks like now. So it's evolved over the years. I got the idea that I wanted to go in to the Kentucky River Regional Jail and do parenting sessions with the incarcerated people there. I got a meeting with the administrator, and he was gracious enough to allow me into his facility. At first, I would go twice a month, and I would do parenting sessions, kind of like a parenting class, and they would write their kids letters, and I would be able to mail those letters after our sessions were over. So they were connecting, you know, through that, but it was really... we were really lacking in like a genuine connection between these parents and their kids. With a lot of community partners, Save the Children, Perry County Schools, you know, of course, the administrator, Lonnie Brewer at the Kentucky River Regional Jail, he's been great. If it weren't for him supporting this, it wouldn't be possible. We have a lot of other community partners that play a big role in it as well.
What are some ways, besides the writing letters, that families have stayed connected? And what does it mean for them and for the community?
Well, now, you know, since the Wonderland of Hope project has taken off, they're able to do visits in person. They are they're still separated by a glass partition, but they're in person. You know, they can look at each other. They know one another is safe. And, you know, that's something that's really big is, the known is a lot easier than the unknown. So when these kiddos see their parent and they see that they're safe and they're okay, they feel a lot better when they leave. You know, because before, kids don't really know when they hear mom or dad's gone. And they may not always know that they're in jail. But the ones who do know that they're in jail, they don't really know if they're okay or not. Mm-hmm. So this gives them an opportunity to see that they are, in fact, they're okay.
So have you actually witnessed improvements in family relations?
I have one family that the child had not seen their incarcerated loved one in over 21 or 22 months. That was a really emotional visit, and it was just great to watch. And now this child is like super excited for these visits, and it's just great.
You know, it strikes me that a time when that separation of child and parent might be really exacerbated would be during a flood like we had in July. What was the experience during that time? Were the parents safe where they were, the incarcerated parents? And of course, I'm sure they were worried about their children.
Yeah. The incarcerated parents, they were all safe. The jail was fine during the flood. But I had, when I would go in, you know, to do my parents' sessions or to, like, talk to the inmates or whatever, they were always asking questions about, like, the area, you know, that their family and children were living in. And everybody was just really worried.
Sure. Well, Wendy, thank you very much. And good work that you're doing there. And we appreciate you taking time. Tara, coming back to you, back to the survey that we talked about a few moments ago, respondents in 65 counties, did you find much interest in doing more to help local jails improve visits for children?
We really did. A lot of local partners, I should say that we had survey respondents that represented nonprofit organizations, faith-based groups, family resource and youth service center employees, teachers, you know, other people in the education system. So we had a whole range of people from different walks of life who responded to the survey. And overall, people were really interested in doing more. And, you know, one of the takeaways that we really had was how important community partners are often in getting things going like this. Certainly, jails have programming and they have opportunities that they can provide on their own, but a lot of times the examples that we heard had examples like the one Wendy shared, where she went and spoke with somebody at the jail and got a conversation going, and that led to this wonderful program where now young kids can go in to a beautifully colored and decorated room with books accessible, and they can sit there and see their loved one through glass, but they can see them and read a book with them, or, you know, have that positive experience. So, you know, communities across Kentucky, community leaders across the state can really step up and go have this conversation with the jail. And I think there's a lot of different ways that they could get something going. So certainly Wendy's program is very much more intensive, where she's supporting parents and has created this positive space for them to have visits. But on the other end of the spectrum, it might be something as simple as different people in the community sharing information with parents or family members, so they have more information about how to support the child who's experiencing the parental incarceration.
Well, I know that there are all kinds of exigencies that an incarcerated parent will walk back out into the world to once they're released. But do you think that programs like this can help reduce recidivism?
Absolutely. Research that has been done at the national level has shown that. And I mentioned that we've spoken with a couple of jailers here in the state of Kentucky that have really seen positive improvements in terms of the behavior of people in the jail. And, you know, they report that what they see is that it helps to prevent people from coming back into jail when they have that family support when they leave. We know, like, just switching gears from being in jail and then all of a sudden being out, that can be a major change and a major shift. And so when people have that family connection, and when they have that connection with their child and they take that responsibility for helping support and raise that child when they leave, that can make a big difference for the decisions they make.
All right, that's Tara Grisham Goodwin from Kentucky Youth Advocates and Wendy Hall, Program Director with Save the Children. And we thank you both for your work and for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, aid for the arts in eastern Kentucky communities hit by the recent flood, designing schools for the future, and why poet Jeff Worley once captured an overheard idea on a banana peel. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, serving members locally in Kentucky for decades. Co-ops exist to serve co-op members. Learn more about Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives at TogetherWeSaveKY.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
When the big flood struck eastern Kentucky in late July, it took lives, homes, businesses, jobs, and a lot of the art in the region. That has the attention of the Kentucky Arts Council, where they have put together a trio of disaster assistance grants for impacted arts organizations, school arts programs, and individual working artists. Tom Musgrave joins us from the Arts Council in Frankfort. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tom.
So, first, a little background on these grants. How did they come about?
After the devastating December tornado in western Kentucky, we started doing an assessment on the impact on the arts field, and found there were several organizations and individual artists who were directly affected. We put together a proposal to the NEA requesting assistance to the field, and received it in July, $115,000. That was, of course, before that unprecedented flood hit eastern Kentucky. So we are now in a position of using that money to assist in both Western and Eastern Kentucky. The upshot to that is arts organizations and individual artists are very good at squeezing value out of a dollar. So we're confident that whatever funding that we put out there is going to be well applied to those situations and that need.
Well, we know that these grants are targeted toward the two disaster areas of Kentucky, the Western Kentucky Tornado Zone. Of course, our coverage area, our listeners are in the Eastern Kentucky segment. So let's focus on that. And if you could tell me who in our coverage area of Eastern Kentucky can apply.
First off, these grants are for individual artists, arts organizations, and for the arts education field. In Eastern Kentucky, the counties that we are serving with these grants are Breathitt, Clay, Floyd, Knott, Lee, Leslie, Letcher, McGoffin, Martin, Owsley, Perry, Pike, and Whitley counties. We took those counties from FEMA, from their declaration of disaster guidelines. So that's the region that in Eastern Kentucky that these grants will apply to.
Okay, let's take a look at each of them. There's an Organization Relief and Disaster Recovery Grant of up to $5,000. What does that do?
That simply assists organizations with general operating expenses on top of what they may already get from us. They don't have to already receive assistance from us through our Kentucky Arts Partnership grant, which is a separate grant that we do every year for arts organizations. Any arts organization can apply for this one. It's for things like keeping the lights on, helping pay staff, paying rent, those sorts of things. And those are important at this time because those organizations have been affected as well. They need help with those basic expenses, and so we're doing our best to get them that support.
And I see here that matching funds are not required for that one, and the applications for this one are due December 12th?
Yes. So it's coming up quickly, and I should add that we have deadlines coming up for those quickly, obviously, but we intend to just as quickly get that support out our doors into the hands of the folks who need it. That's how much we're committed to this.
The next one I see here is the Artist Rescue and Disaster Recovery Grant, again, an award of up to $5,000. Tell us about that one.
That is for individual artists who were affected by the disasters in Western Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky. Again, matching funds are not required for that one. And that will, in Eastern Kentucky, that applies to the counties that we talked about a few moments ago. They need to be practicing artists responsible for creating their own work in compliance with some of our final reporting requirements, and I won't get into the weeds too much there. There are guidelines on our website for those, and I will share links with you if you can put them on your website.
We sure will.
This grant is designed to assist rescue and recovery following these climate disasters in Western Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky. And they represent a recognition of the value of individual artists to Kentucky's economic recovery, up to $5,000, intended to help support practicing Kentucky artists.
Okay, and we know that a lot of schools were hit in Eastern Kentucky, and I see that you have a third grant here, Arts Education Relief and Disaster Recovery Grant, awards up to $1,000. Tell us about that one.
Yes, that grant is unique among the three in that we're accepting applications on a rolling basis, and we are going to be making awards on a rolling basis as well. So when we get an application in, we will evaluate it as quickly as possible and get the aid out as soon as we can. This grant provides Kentucky schools who are impacted by the climate disasters funding for arts education activities. They can use the funding for costs associated with any kind of arts education programming, including but not limited to materials for creative projects, teaching artist residencies, performance assemblies, field trips to arts organizations or venues, which are important because sometimes the cost of transportation is the barrier and the difference between taking the field trip and not taking the field trip sometimes. And this grant is non-competitive, meaning we're not empaneling a jury to take a look at it, but the application is going to be reviewed for completeness. So any teacher or school principal or school leader who's going to apply, just make sure that you fill out the narrative and we will get you help as soon as we can.
Okay, and no matching funds required there either, correct?
Correct.
That's Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council in Frankfort. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
If you were charged with designing schools for the 21st century, what would show up on your drawing board? What needs to be taken into consideration? Things like technologies, innovative learning environments, safety and security. Laura Sakleben thinks about these things in her role as Vice President, Global Education at Stantec, and she joins us from Houston. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Laura.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, great, and we appreciate you taking time for us. Many schools here in eastern Kentucky have been heavily damaged by the recent flash flooding we've had here. It's the kind of weather event that you know too well there in Houston as well. And I'm just wondering, when you're designing new schools, do you take into account this increasing frequency and intensity of weather events?
Absolutely. I would say, especially as you mentioned, I'm in Houston, so we experienced a series of flood events year after year. And then Hurricane Harvey, of course, was a very large event with huge catastrophic impact. But prior to that, we were starting to realize that schools really serve a purpose greater than reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? When we think about those types of climate events that happen, you know, whether it's flooding or tornadoes or fires that we see in California, many times it's the schools that act as the shelters. They are the places that we run to for services, for resources. And so what we know as designers of schools is that our schools have to be built and designed to a greater standard than some of the other facilities that you might see within a community. A lot of us think of hospitals as emergency type places, which they are, but I would argue that the other place that we run to when disaster strikes is our schools, and that there's, you know, a lot of times a lot more people that are relying on them. So in terms of flooding, we are, you know, making sure that we're building the schools out of the floodplain, and if they're not physically out of the floodplain, we're building the floor level of those schools higher than what you would expect other structures perhaps to be built to. And if we're in tornado zones, we're building and designing shelters into those schools so that there's places of refuge in a storm or an emergency.
There's another big dynamic going on right now, too, that I'm sure must affect your thinking, and that is, of course, the pandemic that we've been going through for several years now, at least a couple of years. How have the conditions imposed by this pandemic affected your thinking about future school design?
You know, I'm really glad that you asked that because, you know, we dealt with Hurricane Harvey in 2017. So this is just my personal frame of reference and experience. And so there was a lot of discussion around flooding. And so we started to really focus more heavily on resilience in schools. And what we talked about and what we decided is that we need to be designing not for what we've experienced yesterday or any time in the past, but we need to be designing for the future. So a lot of what we have talked about actually prepared us for the pandemic in a way. And so when the pandemic hit, what we saw is when everything else was shut down, the schools had to find a way to function in some capacity. And even though there weren't students in those buildings, they were still, many of the school districts were still feeding students. And in some cases, they were feeding families as well. A lot of us don't realize that our public schools actually provide a lot of services to our communities, and food is certainly one of those. And that had to continue. And so those schools did that. The other thing we found is that as we started to return after the pandemic, so we started to get kids back in schools with other safety precautions in place, and there's a whole lot of those that a lot of us experienced. But what we saw was that those schools that have been set up and designed previously for 21st century learning environments, which really is a collaborative, student-centered environment that really aims to meet kids and learners where they are, and it acknowledges that we all learn differently. Those schools that were designed in that way fared really well in the pandemic because they're designed to be able to break students up into smaller groups and to spread students throughout the building and really capitalize on every inch of that building for learning, which as you're returning from a pandemic, you know, situation, or you're returning while the pandemic is still going on, it gives you more options. And so those schools were able to house kids effectively, maybe more so than just the traditional classrooms with no other types of space, right? Because you all of a sudden overnight, you couldn't fit as many students in that classroom. But those schools that had flexible learning spaces, different size of spaces, could move kids throughout that building.
You mentioned a couple of things there that I want to come back to. And the first one is a word that's something of a buzzword around here right now with a lot of different contexts. And I'm wondering, what does resilience mean to you as a school designer?
It means a lot of things. And I think what's really tough about resilience is that at its core, you know, a lot of us think about resilience as something physical, and we think about it in terms of damage that we experience, damage that we see. That's how we quantify storms, right? Is how much damage was done to property. But really at its core, resilience is human. It's about the impact on humans and how we are able to thrive in the face of adversity and overcome and move forward. So when I think about resilience in schools, I'm not just thinking about how do we design this building to withstand a potential storm that's going to bring flooding or wind, loss of power or whatever. I'm not just thinking about how do we design this school for a pandemic for resilience. I'm also thinking about how do we design this school for mental well-being? How do we create an environment that's inspiring and creates a collaborative environment for kids to connect with each other, with adults, so that they feel cared for, they feel like they have a future? And then, of course, school safety and all those things, which ties to that mental health as well. So that's the challenging part.
Safety and security is kind of the third leg of the stool of troubling dynamics that we're dealing with these days. We touched on climate change or weather, the pandemic, and you're mentioning school safety and security. And I've just heard talk from Uvalde, Texas, about, you know, erecting 8-foot fences and so forth. But what do you take into consideration if you're designing a brand new school? It's the contract is on your desk and you're starting at square A, and this is a factor that you have to think about now, unfortunately. How does that figure into what you come up with?
It kind of runs through everything, right? So as we're designing a school, we're thinking about what's the kind of environment that we're wanting to create, and we want it to be safe, and we want it to be inspiring. And a lot of times we think of those two things in competition with each other or in opposition. But I would argue that it's about finding the right solutions that address both of those at the same time. And so I think what's important for us to remember is that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to school safety. And that is because, again, you know, similar to resilience, it's not just about physical, right? Its basis is in human interaction and the impact on humans. So we have to approach it keeping that all in mind. So there are basic things that we do in school design, making sure that we have secured entryways so that not just anybody can enter a building, making sure that there's visibility out so that people can see, you know, who's approaching the building. And there's a whole myriad of things that we can do, but we can't just solve that one leg of the stool, as you say, right? I think we have to remember that all of the challenges that we are facing in our community walk in and out of the doors of that school every day. And each of those is going to present itself in a different way. And so we have to think holistically in our approach. We have to design for all those things. And again, same with when we're talking about storms, we can't just design for the experience that we just had. We absolutely need to learn from that, but we need to be looking ahead of that.
Well, learning and education have been evolving for some time now, and certainly accelerating in these times from book-based to technology-based. We're educating digital natives now. How does that influence design?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because when technology first came into our schools, we thought about it as almost a replacement to some of the tools we already had, right? So a lot of times you would see in classrooms, the computer was replacing the pencil, which when you think about the potential of technology, and a lot of it is about where technology was at that point, right? Mm-hmm. But if we're really going to use technology to its full benefit, there's so much more that it can do. When we're designing schools, we make sure that we design the infrastructure in a way that it's going to support the technology that we see today, but also the technology that we don't know. I mean, what we see as a society is technology changes more rapidly than most of the things around us. So it's something it's very hard to keep up with. So we really have to design with flexibility in mind. And we have to make sure that the decisions we're making today will support configurations of learning that we really haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an example, in a classroom, when we first started putting technology in classrooms, it was all about setting up a station for the teacher at the front of the room, and then there might be some other places where you might have computers. Well, today we know that a classroom is much more flexible, that a teacher is not just in one place. The teacher is moving around. Hopefully the furniture is flexible and there's different configurations. So students are meeting in small groups. They might be doing a project, and that technology really might be anywhere in that classroom. And it might be helping them connect to another classroom somewhere else in the world, right? So our design of technology can't be around any one configuration that we have in our head, which makes it a bit challenging.
I was going to say, that must be really tough because your clients are school districts that are making a pretty significant expenditure here to build a new building, a new school, for that matter, a new campus.
Yes.
And yet it has to survive that evolution that seems to be just accelerating exponentially these days, where technology is concerned, where society is concerned, all those things. It must be very difficult. It sounds like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree.
Some days it feels that way. But I would say that the way that we design buildings today and some of the building technologies that we have and the technology around technology is a lot more flexible so that we have a lot more opportunity to kind of prepare for things that we haven't even identified in our own mind. And so where a school that you saw 50 years ago was built with the intention that it was going to look that same way probably 50 years later, the mindset going into it now is when we design a school, our mindset is that much of what we're designing is going to look different in maybe 10 years, you know, and it could be sooner. And so when you approach a design with that mindset, you know, not the mindset of nothing is going to change about this building for the next 50 years, it brings about a different kind of solution.
Well, when you think about innovation, Laura, when you think about the innovations that are at your disposal to figure into a design, what's the coolest thing that comes to mind?
For me, I think some of the coolest things that we see within our projects and our work is when we're able to design a facility that really just taps into the imagination of the students and the staff that are going to walk into that building. And so, you know, we designed a facility that is, you know, it's called a Center for STEAM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Math. And when we designed that building, you know, the discussion was, today there's going to be robotics teams in there and there's going to be, you know, field trips and things of that nature, but they may be building solar cars in here one day and they may be doing this. And so that building was set up so that students could, they had a place to dream up their ideas, bounce those ideas off of others, do research for those ideas, actually start to build and tinker with their ideas, and then a place to test those ideas. And so it's all in one facility. There's these spaces and configurations that support them doing hands-on learning and really inventing, right? And so the hope is that with this, the design of the building, which, you know, what I always say is sometimes you have to design to just get the architecture out of the way so that the activities that happen inside create that innovation that you're looking for. That's what gets me excited.
That's Laura Sakleben, Vice President, Global Education at Stantec in Houston. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you very much.
Tom Eblin returns with the latest in our series on Kentucky writers, authors, and poets.
Poet Jeff Worley is originally from Wichita, Kansas, but he has lived in Lexington for more than 30 years. A retired journalist and English professor, he was Kentucky's Poet Laureate from 2019 to 2021. He edited the book What Comes Down to Us, an anthology of 25 contemporary Kentucky poets published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2009. His latest book of his own poetry is called The Poet Laureate of Aurora Avenue. The book, published by Broadstone Books in Frankfurt, is a sort of greatest hits album. It features selected poems from six previous books written over more than three decades. Worley's poetry is filled with both humor and heartache, reminding us of the joys, sorrows, and absurdity of everyday life. Richard Taylor, another former Kentucky Poet Laureate, calls Worley a poet's poet, who seems motivated not by what he thinks editors want to publish, but what people want to read. Jeff Worley journeyed half a block from his home on Aurora Avenue to be with us in the studio today. Jeff, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Well, thanks. Always good to see you, Tom.
Well, in your biography, it says you have published more than 500 poems over the years. How did you go about selecting the few for this book?
Well, what I did, first of all, this was a kind of natural and necessary thing for me to do, the selected poems, because I wanted my earlier poems to find an audience. And my first and third books, for example, from Midlist Press in Minneapolis, are out of print. Midlist went out of business in about 2010. And so I don't even have but about 8 or 10 copies of my own books from Midlist. And I wanted to resurrect some of these old poems.
Well, how'd you choose? Well, I mean, whittling it down from 500 to what's in this book must have been a task.
I haven't counted. I'm not sure how many are in here. But actually, it was kind of easy because what I did is I went through and I thought, well, this is a good poem. I think it has held up. So I was looking for that, and I was also looking for in 2022, which of these poems are likely to resonate with readers, readers who care about poetry. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty easy to decide which ones to highlight.
Yeah. Well, one thing I've always enjoyed about your poetry is the humor. Why do you like to write humorous poems, and why do you think other poets don't?
A number of poets do, and I've always been attracted to those poets. Well, I think humor is a gift that gets us through from day to day, and maybe especially when things are really tough, as they've been for the last few years with COVID and other things as well. I don't know that you can learn to write humor as much as it seems to come more naturally, I think, for some people.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think makes a good poem?
Boy, that's about a 30-minute answer I've got, but I'll try to make it less.
Give me the 2 or 3 minute version.
2 or 3 minute. I think a good poem engages a reader. It gives the reader something new to look at, something new to think about, or if it's a narrative poem, some new experience that the reader probably hasn't had and maybe never will experience. But I think we all gain a lot out of both poetry and fiction with vicarious experiences that we can have, especially when a writer gets the language right.
Mm-hmm. We know a lot of people quit reading poetry after they get out of school. And why would you recommend that people should read poetry?
Well, I think it's an immediate way to connect with the world. And imagistic poetry in particular, I think, does that. Take a poet like Mary Oliver and read one of her poems. You simply feel a whole lot more about your surroundings that you wouldn't have felt before if you hadn't read her poetry. And narrative poems work the same way, just with stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, this collection of poetry dates back, I guess, at least to the early 90s. That was your first book was in 1995. How do you think your poetry has changed over the years?
That's a great question. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I think it hasn't changed all that much. I hope the poems overall are stronger and more memorable, but I've been writing about the same things from the beginning, and I think a whole lot of poets do. We write about love and loss and interesting experiences we've had and interesting little snippets of conversation that we're lucky enough to hear. So I don't know that my poetry has really changed all that much.
You mentioned that some of these poems are based on experiences, kind of interesting, funny things that happened to you. Another one, for instance, in the old Two Keys Tavern downtown, and another in, a motorcycle bar in Paducah.
Right.
What type of experiences do you sit, have something happen and say, man, this is a good poem?
I'll give you an example of that, and that's I find myself at Kroger quite a lot because I like to give them as much money as I can of mine. And some years back, I was lucky enough to be walking behind a man and his son who I would guess is about maybe 6 years old. That was my guess. And I happened to hear, "Dad, we have two arms. We have two eyes. We have two legs. Why don't we have two penises?" I couldn't get to a piece of paper fast enough. I always have a pen, but I think I ended up writing that on a banana peel because it was the closest thing that I could use. And that's just what William Stafford used to say is lucky talk, mm-hmm. that you happen to overhear that. My mistake was that instead of trying to find something to write on and so forth so that I didn't forget this, I never got his answer. Mm. I don't know what Dad said about that, but I wish I had that somehow.
Yeah. Well, when you were the State Poet Laureate, one of your projects was your poetry box outside your house, and you put poems from other people in there. Who are some of your favorite poems? I noticed as I was walking over here today, you had Maya Angelou's famous poem, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Mm-hmm. Who are some of your favorite poets?
Well, I hate this question, Tom, because I always, no matter how many names I mention, I'm going to leave out some that are favorite poets. But Mary Oliver, I've mentioned, Stephen Dunn, Stephen Dobbins, In Kentucky, there are many, and I was lucky enough to put my favorite poets into the anthology that you mentioned. Richard Taylor, I think, is a terrific poet, and this guy named Wendell Berry is starting to catch on.
Yeah, he's got a real promise. Well, what are you writing these days?
I've been working mostly on this book to get it right because it's important to me. Hmm. To resurrect some of these poems, and the job of doing this wasn't so bad because by the time I send a poem to a magazine, it has been worked pretty thoroughly. I rewrite some poems I put away for a year or two, get back to them, and I've been lucky to have a poetry group in Lexington that a poet named Marcia Herlow and I founded in about 1990. Mm-hmm. And these are good poets, good readers, and we get together, although we're on a bit of a hiatus now, we get together and help each other workshop our poems. So by the time I have a poem that I think is finished, or as Paul Valery would have it, abandoned, it's pretty much going to stay that way. There are some poets who do a selected poems and end up revising a lot of their early poems, but I didn't revise anything. I just wanted to leave them as they were, as they have been.
Jeff, thanks for being with us today. Once again, the book is The Poet Laureate of Aurora Avenue, Selected Poems by Jeff Worley. For Eastern Standard, this is Tom Evelyn with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.